The House had previously adopted amendments to let states retain oil spill laws that are tougher than federal regulations in the House bill. Today, the big issue is whether to require double hulls or double bottoms for oil transport ships. House members ultimately decided to require them, but only after lengthy debate. The House approved a combined double-hull, double-bottom amendment sponsored by New Jersey Congressman Dean Gallo and Robert Torricelli. It requires all oil tankers and tank barges to be built with double hulls or retrofitted within 15 years. Tankers would also be required to be built with double bottoms or retrofitted within 7 years. Torricelli stated the case for his amendment.
If we learn anything from the Alaska oil spill, it is this.
A substitute was offered to require double hulls only if a study by the National Academy of Sciences and the Coast Guard determines it the best way to prevent spills. Congressman Don Young argued that was a more sensible approach.
We have an ongoing study, and if it is found that double bottoms are in fact the only and best method to prevent a spill, then we shall adopt that method. But if it is a better method, a different ballasting, a different structure, then that should be the method that is adopted.
Torricelli later replied the substitute was just another delay.
The fact is, the substitute is designed to provide an out, an option, an escape, to avoid the consequences of what we should have been doing for 30 years, what this House should have done 15 years ago, and that is to have double bottoms.
Torricelli's amendment won out. Earlier, a number of amendments breezed through. One assured that funds recovered for damage to natural resources be kept in a revolving trust fund. Another directed the Coast Guard to determine whether ships should be put on automatic pilot in confined waters. Yet another mandated drug and alcohol testing for people seeking maritime licenses or working on ships. A provision to place a fee on Trans-Alaska pipeline oil for environmental restoration after the pipeline shuts down was withdrawn, but its sponsor said he may introduce it in another form later. Before final passage of the oil spill legislation, the House got a second shot at an amendment passed yesterday that tightened negligence standards for oil shippers or facility operators. This time it was rejected. The House and Senate will now have to work out differences in their versions of the oil spill legislation. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
The Alaska, through this compliance order, is agreeing to respond to discharges from any loaded tankers that are doing trade at their port that occur in Prince William Sound. In other words, if a spill occurs from a tanker in Prince William Sound, or if a spill occurs outside Prince William Sound but may impact Prince William Sound, Alaska will respond with their new complement of equipment to that spill and contain and clean up.
The capability of existing technology to clean up an oil spill was questioned early on in the meeting by Lauren Flagg of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association. Flagg said that the state and the industry should focus on preventing a spill because once it happens, it's next to impossible to clean it up. The biologist was recently in Norway, which is believed to be a leader in oil spill technology, and he saw firsthand how the equipment works after a tanker ran aground just a few miles from a conference he was attending.
Due to the weather conditions, very little of the oil could be contained or picked up for 2 days following the accident. The oil was driven ashore into the fjords by winds and tide. Mariculture farms, salmon streams, marine birds, private properties were all threatened by the spill. Most of the oil ended up on shore, and an extensive cleanup expected to last several weeks was begun. The point I'm trying to make is that prevention cannot be overemphasized. The Norwegians, with the best equipment and response capability in the world, could not control this relatively small spill. Once the oil is in the water, especially in Cook Inlet, with our extreme tides, the ball game is over.
Flagg said he wasn't opposed to gearing up for an oil spill and making sure the necessary equipment is on hand. He said he just wanted to make it clear that the primary focus should be on prevention. Ed Murphy of the Southwest Pilots Association agreed. Murphy said that steps should be taken to improve the system. The pilot said Alaska is the easiest state in the country to receive a pilot's license, and the procedure needs to be improved. The Houma resident also had some advice for the Coast Guard. Murphy, who pilots tankers through Cook Inlet, said the Coast Guard needs to enforce its own regulations. He cited an example of a problem he encountered recently.
On Wednesday, September 20th, I anchored a vessel out in Homer called the Flying Cloud, a foreign flag tanker of some 80,000 tons deadweight. It was to anchor for a couple of hours and go up to the KPL dock at Nikiski. I told the captain that I wouldn't take him up the inlet because his gyro compass didn't work and he had to have it fixed. He was unhappy, but he accepted the situation. The next morning, they went up the inlet because his agent had contacted the Coast Guard and they'd given him a waiver. Now, that's a little discouraging to civilians like me who have a passing knowledge of the Code of Federal Regulations, and I know that an operating gyro compass on a tanker is one of the federal requirements. And I would suggest that if the Coast Guard will enforce its own regulations, that will be a big help.
Coast Guard Captain Rich Asaro said he wasn't aware of the case that Murphy was referring to, but said if the Coast Guard granted a waiver, it was because it felt the tanker could safely navigate through Cook Inlet. Borough Mayor Don Gilman, who moderated the meeting, said the Coast Guard's action appeared to be an unnecessary gamble.
What would have happened if that tanker hadn't made it to Nikiski? You'd have rolled the dice and lost.
Hoping to improve the odds of a disaster not taking place, the State Oil Spill Commission will be making recommendations to the legislature in January. Commission Chairman Walt Parker said the commission wants to see two oil spill response vessels in Cook Inlet. It's also recommending a vessel monitoring system that would track tankers as they come through the inlet. Parker said those two recommendations may take some time to implement, but there are other areas where action could be taken immediately to improve safety.
Mandatory drug and alcohol testing already underway. Training for emergency operations, loading and unloading operations in high-risk navigation areas, primarily utilizing simulators. Port closure procedures to ensure that they exist and are utilized. A two-person watch-standing requirement, one of whom can be the pilot, obviously, but ensure that all times that two certified watch-standers are on the bridge certified for in the interior waters they're operating in.
Parker said the Oil Spill Commission will be holding hearings on its recommendations this week in Anchorage. There was a lot of talk on a wide range of subjects at the three-hour meeting in Homer. All sides felt the discussion was worthwhile, and many expressed interest in another such forum in the future. Mike O'Meara of the Kachemak Bay Conservation Society said he was pleased by the fact people are talking, but he was concerned that not enough action is being taken. O'Meara said he would like to see the Department of Environmental Conservation take advantage of legislation that allows the state to fine companies that spill oil. At the end of Friday's meeting, O'Meara had these words for the panel members.
I, too, am glad to see this happening, but as I listened to everyone speak, something that was said long ago by Chief Joseph enters into my mind. I'm tired of talk that comes to nothing. It makes my heart sick when I remember all the good words and all the broken promises. I would hope that it goes further than that here.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
As the Alaska Oil Spill Commission reconvened in Anchorage, an industry spokesman said he's waiting to see what state and local response plans look like before specific plans are made for Cook Inlet. I'm Sue Burris. Representatives of two oil industry-supported organizations testified before the commission, explaining their new programs.
Puro is not while a creature of big oil, as it were, is going to be an independent, not-for-profit corporation. We're not going to make money. We're going to be a public service organization. And cynics may not like to hear that, but the plain bald fact of the matter is that the industry has pledged $250 million to this effort over 5 years.
The corporation the industry is forming, Stephen Duca pointed out, is nonprofit with an independent board of directors. Duca is the vice president for external affairs and readiness at Piro Implementation Incorporated, a company formed by contributions from the oil industry to set up the actual permanent nonprofit petroleum industry response organization, or Piro.
Very, very capable businessmen have come to the conclusion that it's good business to see that what Alaska has suffered in terms of the Valdez experience and industry has suffered with it, by the way, is not repeated.
Pirro plans to designate and equip regional response centers around the United States, but has none planned for Alaska. They're counting on Alyeska to be the major response center here. If they decide to do anything in Cook Inlet, it will depend on what state and local plans turn out to be. Pirro plans call for the oil company responsible for the spill to also be responsible for cleaning it up. The company might call on Pirro assistance in a contractual arrangement. Pirro would function as an independent contractor. Duca said his organization recommends the federal government should direct and manage response and cleanup efforts. The interim organization, Pirro Implementation Incorporated, is inventorying oil spill cleanup equipment and resources currently available and determining what may need to be custom manufactured to have the full system operating by 1991. The American Petroleum Institute actually recommended the formation of Pirro in a report last June. Brian Dorsch of Chevron Shipping testified before the Oil Commission on behalf of API. He focused on specific API recommendations on vessel traffic system, pilots, tugboat assistance, drug and alcohol testing, and staffing requirements. But too often his response to the commission had to be like his answer to a specific question about the priorities of the API budget.
I could only speculate, and I'm not qualified to answer that. I didn't come up with the API budget. I'm not part of the API.
When the discussion turned to double-bottom construction for tankers, Dorsch stuck by API's evaluation. If the Exxon Valdez had been double-hulled, it would have sunk. But he was pressured by the commission because his company, Chevron, has some double-hulled tankers, and commissioners asked if he felt safety had been traded for other advantages in the decision to go with the double-hulled ships.
I'm not saying that double-hulled ships are less safe. I'm saying that there are certain circumstances where they provide more of a hazard than a single hull. There are also circumstances where they are safer.
Dorsch hopes that a report being prepared by the National Research Council will clarify the matter further. The commission will be meeting in Anchorage through Thursday. For APRN, I'm Sue Burris.
Are otters continuing to die right now? Can they reproduce normally? Has the oil spill affected their long-term feeding habits? We're depending on the wild otters in the study program to be our monitors to help us with the answers to these questions. The alternative to not doing this research study is basically to say, adios otters, and let them swim off and just hope that nothing harmful is happening to them in the future. And we just think that's irresponsible.
The data gathered during the next year by the company Impact Assessment Incorporated will be used to develop strategies to deal with the long-term effects of the Exxon Valdez oil spill and provide long-term planning. The $600,000 study was discussed Wednesday during the Alaska Municipal League Convention in Juneau. Dr. Charles Smith with the Alaska Department of Community and Regional Affairs says the study was spearheaded by the Oiled Mayors Group.
First, it'll just provide basic information about what happened in the first year of the spill and what happened in each of the different communities. But it'll also provide information that for monitoring, you know, plans and templates for monitoring future years. And then for planning for future disasters and long-term contingency planning for other situations like this, it'll be, you know, provide a framework and recommendations for doing that.
Smith says there will be three phases of the study. The first part will look at the fiscal and service demands on local governments with projections of impact costs over the next 3 years.
Assessing the effects on revenue sources to municipalities, but also what happened to businesses, dislocations among different businesses and among different economic sectors in the communities. And then task three is looking at the social and psychological impacts and effects in the communities, primarily focusing on family and community organization and changes in functioning of those groups.
Four firms, including two from Alaska, sought the contract. Smith says the California firm was chosen because of its experience in dealing with communities. The study is scheduled to be completed in August 1990. In Juneau, I'm Claire Richardson.
I did come back from the trip to France with more optimism than I'd had when I left. You'll remember that the French not only had the Amoco Cadiz, but they had the Torrey Canyon, and actually a total of 7 major oil spills on the Brittany coast in the past 20 years.
What did you see? I mean, is there anything still to be seen there of those seven oil spills?
Actually, very little. We did find oil, but to find oil, we dug down in the sand, and we were able to find traces of oil in the sand. But essentially, everything on the Brittany coast has returned to normal.
Did the French officials have any lessons to pass on for achieving that level of normalcy or for dealing with the oil companies?
Yes, actually, we met with quite a number of their scientists. We met with their fishermen, and we met with people from the tourism industry. And I think, you know, they're jealous of us, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but they are jealous that Exxon has spent as much money and has done as much of the labor in Prince William Sound as they have, because the French have received very, very little help in terms of their oil spills. Generally, it's the people in the French communities that mobilize in a volunteer effort and go out and try and clean it up. They did mention to us, and I think they were somewhat miffed in that they had come to Valdez to meet with Exxon after our spill and attempted to provide advice, and they didn't feel that Exxon was very receptive to what they had been trying to provide them. But they have a lot of technology that they've developed over the years, and at one point they mentioned that they thought Exxon was reinventing wheels when they could have taken advantage of some of the technology that they had.
Is there some of that advice that you think can still be used, say, in the coming cleanup season?
Well, hopefully there will be a coming cleanup season. I'm not all that optimistic that Exxon is going to come back and do more cleanup next season, but I hope they do because we need it. The French talked about bioremediation, and they also talked about some of the chemicals that they had used in their cleanup that would be helpful. Now, whether or not Exxon or the state of Alaska will utilize the information that's available from a country that's had more oil spills than I hope we ever have, I just really don't know.
Well, you went on to Norway, I know, just in time for another significant oil spill there. And the Norwegians, of course, are highly regarded for their expertise in oil spill containment cleanup. Did you see that expertise in action, and did you think there's anything to be learned there?
Yes, actually, we went to Norway. There was a major conference. In fact, it was the first international conference on offshore drilling and fisheries, and it was held in Bergen, Norway. And the day that I arrived in Bergen, a large bulk carrier that went up on the rocks just a little north of Bergen, and after the conference was over, which would have been day two or day three of the spill, I rented a car, and Erling Johansson and Matt Miller and I drove up to the site of the spill, and we were given a very good tour of their operation. We went into their control room, and then they took us out in a helicopter. They were doing a flyover to see how the oil spill was progressing. And we saw the ship, of course, and then we saw the spill. I think the most important bit of information that comes out of that is that here Norway is with one of the top oil spill response programs in the world. In fact, in my estimation, and of course it's limited because I haven't looked at that many, but I think Norway's is probably the best. And they had seas that ranged between 9 and 15 feet, which we have a lot of that in this country. And they couldn't hold the oil. There was no way they couldn't pick it up. They couldn't stop it. Their booms would not hold the oil in 9-foot seas. They were getting a lot of criticism in the Norway press because they were unable to hold this oil. And it did get into some of their fish farms and caused them some major problems in the fish farms.
So what do you think are the big lessons, both from the visit to France and the visit to Norway?
Well, there are lessons. There are definitely some major lessons there. I think I came away with some impressions. I also went to England and looked at the Torrey Canyon site also. And, of course, the Torrey Canyon not only hit the Cornwall coast, but it also hit France. But in looking at all of that, number one, and we heard this by the way, in the conference in Norway, that nature is very resilient. I don't know how long we can attack nature and expect it to be resilient, but both in France, Norway, and England, nature did pop back.
This is the same group that we used from 1975 to 77 in setting up the original Valdez system, which if it had been carried out, we wouldn't all be here. There would have been no accident.
Captain Joseph Hazelwood is facing a variety of criminal charges stemming from the wreck of the Exxon Valdez and the largest oil spill in North American history. The charges, including criminal mischief and operating a vessel while intoxicated, carry a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison and $100,000 in fines. Hazelwood's lawyers are asking the judge to throw the case out. Defense attorney Richard Friedman cites a U.S. federal law that grants immunity to anyone who spills oil and then reports it to the Coast Guard.
What that means is that not only can his report not be used against him, but also anything his report leads investigators to. So in other words, our position is that nothing flowing from his initial call can be used against him in a criminal trial.
The case is set for trial on January 22nd. For APRN, this is Diana Derby.
We see it as an apolitical expression, with our focus being towards reconciling ourselves towards how humans need to survive in their environment and also have the need for 20th century technology. There can be a whole range of things that will be submitted, and we're really curious as to the number and the nature of entries that we'll get.
Hazelwood's attorneys are trying to make sure the skipper never goes on trial. Their main challenge is based on immunity. Federal law and state regulations saying someone who reports an oil spill can't be prosecuted for that spill. Hazelwood called the Coast Guard on March 24th, saying he was fetched up hard aground on Bly Reef and leaking, and his lawyers say that's enough to shield him from prosecution. Superior Court Judge Carl Johnstone says he's leaning against granting Hazelwood the broadest kind of immunity available under the law. That neutralizes the defense argument that the mere act of reporting the spill is enough to protect Hazelwood. Now the legal dance is centered on a more subtle distinction. The defense is arguing that Hazelwood's statement that the tanker is leaking can't be used against him, and neither can anything else that derives from that statement, including much of the investigation undertaken by the state. That leaves the state's attorney, Bob Linton, trying to prove it was inevitable that the grounding and the spill would have been found and investigated.
Our position is that at some point, the consequences of the spill become so great that persons would have become aware of it, even if there had been no report. In fact, even if the master of a vessel had exercised his Fifth Amendment rights, which he shouldn't really have, and simply remained silent, that is, if the vessel had gone aground and Captain Hazelwood, in this case, not made any report at all, would this spill have been found and when?
Within 4 days of the spill, state attorneys realized that any future legal case could be covered by the immunity issue, exactly the kind of immunity now claimed by Hazelwood's lawyers. In an effort to insulate themselves from information that could have been tainted by Hazelwood's statements, Linton set up two parallel sets of investigations. One group would use all of the information available, including Hazelwood's statements. The second group of prosecutors would operate without the benefit of Hazelwood's remarks and investigations by the Coast Guard and other agencies. The idea was to prove that the state could have gotten all the information it now has, even without Hazelwood. But defense attorney Richard Freeman says it doesn't work that way.
And the point is this, that the entire investigation was completed, or virtually the entire investigation was completed, before they took any actions to protect Captain Hazelwood under this immunity claim. What that means is that they really are trying to unring the bell. All of this was put together before they even addressed the immunity issue. When they finally address the issue, they are trying to cut this off, get the benefits of everything, all his statements, everything that they were led to from his statements,
without paying the price that Congress and, in our case, in the state, the state regulatory agencies expected.
Freeman won't be calling witnesses to back up his case. Instead, he'll try to knock holes in the testimony offered by state witnesses. Captain Hazelwood won't be taking the stand either. The proceeding is expected to last 2 weeks. If defense attorneys fail in their effort to block the state charges, Hazelwood's trial will start January 22nd. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Meltzer.
On the line with me now is Anchorage attorney Bob Wagstaff. He has 22 years of experience in Alaska courtrooms, both criminal and civil. He's appeared twice before the Supreme Court of the United States, and he's past president of the Alaska Bar Association. The initial reaction to this claim of immunity was that it was fairly frivolous, but it seems now from the state's reaction designing this clean team of attorneys that they're taking it very seriously.
Well, as well they should. It is quite serious and a very complex issue that's presented. It's certainly far from a simple one. The heart of it is that the state law provides that there shall be at least a form of immunity given to anyone who reports an oil spill. That's what happened here. Captain Hazelwood, in his first transmission, reported an oil spill. And so I think the question is not really whether this statute or regulation applies, but how it applies, what it means. And the state's position, and they filed a 52-page memorandum on this issue, is what they refer to as the doctrine of inevitable discovery. They would have found out about it, and therefore any immunity, such as it may exist, is pretty minor.
Yeah, I believe they said that it would have been discovered at any rate by something like 8:20 in the morning.
Right.
People getting up and planes going overhead and whatnot. Is there case law on that? Do judges agree that there's this inevitable point where after which you can count the evidence?
Well, there is no case law on this precise issue, and I think both parties are in agreement that there's no case that directly applies to this situation in any other state or federal court. So this is what's called a matter of first impression. Judge Johnstone will be breaking new ground, making law when he does sort out the conflicting arguments on how far this immunity goes.
The defense claims that every piece of evidence the state has is somehow connected to Hazelwood's original call and that it's impossible to build an untainted case. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's certainly where it becomes confusing and difficult because the state carries the burden of showing, if the court is going to follow use immunity, the state has the burden of showing that this information did indeed come from some other source. And that's hard to do, although unquestionably it's very hard to do, although the state has attempted to do that and attempted to do it early on when they realized there was going to be a problem with immunity of setting up a separate prosecutorial team. But as you can see, and just attempting to discuss the issues that are presented here, it's a very complex fabric that is presented for the court to attempt to unravel. So Judge Johnstone will earn his pay on this one because it's quite difficult, involves matters not only of public policy but of basic constitutional rights of the accused, and I know that Judge Johnstone will be very aware of the record in this case because obviously it's not going to stop here. It's going to go before the Alaska Supreme Court, so having an adequate record for the Supreme Court to review will be another consideration. So.
Yeah, I know they're going through a very lengthy piece-by-piece examination of the state's evidence now. It seems like the complexity of this issue could make this a seemingly endless trial.
Well, it is. I mean, it's sort of like a hall of mirrors that keeps getting worse and worse in trying to sort out the immunity issue. So I think this is the opening round of a very lengthy and mind-bending litigation over the scope of this immunity and how far the immunity protects with regards to the entire case. Judge Johnstone will be breaking new ground when he does sort out the conflicting arguments on how far this immunity goes.
Without discussing the substance of it, have you been privy to any discussions regarding potential settlement or resolution of this case short of trial?
Yes, I have.
Tuesday, the state rolled out its clean team. Four lawyers and troopers the state says are untainted by Joe Hazelwood's report that the Exxon Valdez spilled oil into Prince William Sound. Defense lawyers say Hazelwood's March 24th radio call to the Coast Guard. Tuesday, the state rolled out its clean team. Four lawyers and troopers the state says are untainted by Joe Hazelwood's report that the Exxon Valdez spilled oil into Prince William Sound. Defense lawyers say Hazelwood's March 24th radio call to the Coast Guard. The call saying the Exxon Valdez was leaking some oil gives him immunity, and all the facts and investigations that grow out of that report of leaking oil cannot be used as evidence against him. The state says it's capable of investigating the oil spill without using information derived from Hazelwood's initial report, even though much of that information was plastered all over the radio, newspapers, and televisions. The clean team tactic is reminiscent of efforts by federal prosecutors investigating the conspiracy case of Oliver North. In that case, too, prosecutors were shielded from widely publicized details delivered by North himself. Attorney Brent Cole was brought in to head the untainted team of prosecutors. He spent Tuesday afternoon on the witness stand, recounting in detail almost every time he heard about the Exxon Valdez oil spill and steps he took to avoid getting information he wasn't supposed to have.
My dad's an attorney in Fairbanks. My uncle's an attorney in Fairbanks. They ask me questions. My mom asks me questions. My mom sends me clippings from going on, what's going on in Fairbanks. I had to tell her to stop.
Working in parallel to Cole's team is a bank of lawyers and investigators headed up by Bob Linton. He sorted out the tainted and untainted information. Clean team member Marianne Henry describes how the system worked when her boss, Larry Weeks, assigned her to the Hazelwood case.
Larry Weeks told me that he wanted me to look into the case and see if we had sufficient evidence to present it to the grand jury. At that point, he told me that they were looking at potential charges of felony criminal mischief. He also explained that the problem with Mr. Linton was, that he had received some information that he could not use, and so that we were going to be building up what he called a Chinese wall, where Mr. Linton would screen information and give it to me, and then from there I could make decisions.
But defense attorney Rick Friedman argues the state may have built a Chinese wall, but then it threw evidence over the top, things like leads on who to investigate and other information that was derived directly from Hazelwood's report of spilled oil. In cross-examining Marianne Henry, defense attorney Friedman tried to prove she could not have stayed untainted even if she wanted to.
Now, when Mr. Linton would give you a particular report, a particular piece of information, you yourself would have no way of determining whether that was derived from the original report or not, would you?
I wouldn't have any idea.
Okay. And even today, you wouldn't have any idea of that, would
no.
you?
No.
The issue of tainted and untainted evidence is emerging as a key one in this hearing. Based on the way the defense is presenting the case, the state is being asked to disclose all the information it plans to use against Hazelwood in a trial and show how it got the evidence and why it isn't tainted. Over the next few days, the discussions will become even more detailed than they are now as lawyers argue over the fine points of evidence, who knew what, when, and how did they find out. In Anchorage, I'm Bruce Melzer.
Representatives from NOAA, the state, Exxon, and the Coast Guard are meeting with oil spill experts from around the world this week to discuss cleanup technologies and to begin preliminary plans for spring cleaning. NOAA researcher Jackie Michelle says there has been slow but steady removal of oil from surface areas of affected beaches in Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska this winter, but she says little oil from the subsurface has been eroded since cleanup efforts shut down in September. Michelle says oil has penetrated up to 4 feet deep into the ground at some sites. Some of that oil will resurface and be washed away, but eventually oil that has soaked into the beaches will harden. Michelle says it won't be known how much of the oil will be trapped in the ground until the end of next year, after the oil can be warmed again by summer temperatures. But Andy Teal, coordinator of Exxon's Shoreline Monitoring Program, says their test samples show substantial amounts of subsurface oil has been eroded away by winter storms.
We did do a number of test pits in various locations, and what we are seeing is, especially after that November storm, which was after Jackie's evaluations and her information, does in fact indicate that there is significant erosion, exposure, and removal of the sediments and the oil. We do have some areas where undoubtedly there are some subsurface conditions where there is some stranded oil remaining. We're monitoring those very closely, and we will continue to do so.
Teal says any oil remaining on the shoreline is being heavily weathered. The lighter, more toxic materials and crude oil are washed away more easily, leaving the heavier tar-like residues. Biologically speaking, he says, those aren't as significant. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Michael Jones.
Now, when Mr. Litton would give you a particular report, a particular piece of information, you yourself would have no way of determining whether that was derived from the original report or not, would you?
I wouldn't have any idea.
Okay. And even today, you wouldn't have any idea of that, would
no.
you?
No.
A lot of the other accidents that we refer to for the historical perspective were untreated. And we see then large asphalt pavements at those sites, extensive pavements and extensive pockets of oil that remain. We see a lot of oil shorelines that were clean naturally, but here, because of the large volume of free oil that was removed in the summer, that pavement problem is going to be a lot more reduced.
I was in favor of indicting Greg Cousins. Marianne was, and Henry was in favor of indicting Greg Cousins. The investigator, Jim Stocksdale, was in favor of indicting Greg Cousins. Dwayne McConnell, as I remember, was in favor. Larry Weeks was against it. Dean Cunelli was against it.
Brent Cole is one of the state's prosecutors in the case. He's been shielded from information about exactly what happened on March 24th as a direct result of Joseph Hazelwood reporting the Exxon Valdez hard aground and leaking oil. Hazelwood's lawyers were particularly interested in how the Cousins' decision was made, trying to see if what Cole knew was influenced in any way by the knowledge he could only have gotten as a result of Hazelwood's report to the Coast Guard. Part of that question appeared to hinge on when Larry Weeks, Cole's boss, talked with Cousins' attorney. Judge Johnstone entered the questioning of Cole to clarify when the conversation between Cousins' attorney and Mr. Weeks took place. Cole said he had heard of that conversation just before the decisions were made on who to indict.
It went, do we indict both of them, do we indict both of them, do we indict both of them? No, we only indict Captain Hazelwood.
Cole said it was Weeks' decision not to allow the indictment of Greg Cousins. It was obvious that being questioned on the witness stand about the actions of his boss put Cole in an uncomfortable situation.
They felt that Mr. Cousins could help them out in their civil case, and they didn't want to make him an enemy in their civil case. There was other things. There was... he constantly referred to not wanting to go down the line, but wanting to go up the line. Mm-hmm. That was another reason that he gave. Mm-hmm. He felt that the facts didn't support Greg Cousins being indicted.
Prosecutor Larry Weeks in Juneau confirmed today it was his decision not to prosecute Cousins. He said the staff saw some tactical advantages to it, but he felt if they were going to prosecute anyone else, they should go up toward Exxon rather than down. A statement was finally read to the grand jury asking them not to consider indictments against Greg Cousins. The prosecutors consulted with each other about who would be called as witnesses before the grand jury, strategies they would follow, and charges that would be brought. Weeks also determined what evidence Cole and the other shielded prosecutors would be allowed to see and hear. Now Hazelwood's attorneys want to know exactly what of that evidence Cole plans to introduce if the case comes to trial. Attorney Richard Friedman said there is a line of cases on immunity which say that the state has the burden of presenting each piece of evidence it plans to use at trial and convincing the judge that it's untainted. So he put Cole on the spot.
I would like to ask you to tell us which pieces of evidence, as things stand now, you plan to introduce at the trial of the case.
Assistant District Attorney Bob Linton objected to the question, saying it was unfair. One purpose of the hearing is to decide whether Cole is entitled to get some pieces of evidence, and he said this question would be asking, do you want to use something you don't even know about at this point? Judge Carl Johnstone commented he would rather determine if Hazelwood's statement, "We've gone hard aground," would provide an independent source, or whether the independent discovery doctrine applies and what the cutoff date would be before he takes up the questions of evidence to be considered.
Well, Mr. Cole has testified he doesn't know about a lot of the evidence. It may come in because the entire day of the 24th has been excluded from his consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And if, for example, I did decide inevitable discovery doctrine applied, sometime in the middle of the 24th, for example, there'd be other evidence that he would then become aware about. And the evidence that would be necessarily tainted, you wouldn't have to ask about anyway.
Right.
The attorney agreed to hold off asking the evidence question until the judge makes his decision. He promised to do that before the end of the hearing. In Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
Patrick Gullifson, Juneau criminal attorney, you're a former district attorney. Is this unusual for the state to have to virtually disclose all its evidence before the trial even begins?
No, not really. Now, from what I read in the papers, this case is extraordinary in the sense that there are a lot of people, a lot of agencies, and thus a lot of time and effort is probably being spent in disclosing evidence to the defendant, but in the normal criminal case, there would be an obligation to, on the state's part, to disclose most, if not all, of its evidence to the defendant beforehand. So, in that sense, this isn't unusual, in the sense that the time and expense involved in satisfying that obligation in this case, that would probably make it unusual.
All right, so as far as you can tell, just without knowing all the details of the particular facts in this case, There's nothing in having to disclose all this information now and how they got it that should, in and of itself, hurt the chances of making a successful prosecution?
Only having read about the case in the newspaper, Peter, the process itself of disclosing the evidence would not create an extra burden, I wouldn't think, other than simply the time and expense involved in doing so, but it would have to be done at some stage anyway.
Are there any other potential unusual liabilities here in terms of this, the remarkable disclosures they're having to make now in terms of every piece of evidence and this the so-called clean team of attorneys?
Well, I guess the only thing unusual in that respect in the process now is that the disclosure in a way goes directly to the attorneys on the other side, and they participate in examining the witnesses to obtain disclosure to the extent that they're doing that, whereas in the otherwise normal criminal case, disclosure would come to the defense in the form of copies of interviews, transcripts of interviews, police reports, government reports, that sort of thing, so that normally the discovery process is done by the state giving to physically the defense what its file discloses, not subjecting witnesses to examination at some length. Although I would add that where motions are filed in a criminal case having to do with immunity or the suppression of evidence, there are often hearings where the defense is entitled to cross-examine the witnesses and the state has the burden of satisfying the court that the way in which it obtained the evidence is legitimate or that the statute that's been raised has not been violated.
It seems that the prosecution is perhaps losing a little bit of its control over the pretrial activities, but nothing too drastic as far as we can tell?
Not as far as I can tell from reading the newspaper. Those involved might feel differently.
Jim Butler, the Kenai Peninsula Borough's oil spill liaison, says the core issue of concern is liability. He says under the terms of the funding agreement, the state would approve winter cleanup plans, and the borough would carry the plans out. But the responsibility for that work would fall entirely on the borough's shoulders.
Well, there's questions that have to do with if a work plan is approved and people go out and work in an area and the beach is impacted in a negative way, let's say the crew, there's some impact because of the crew's presence, or if there's a liability associated with the workers themselves in the event of an accident or an injury. There's just a number of questions, and I think that it's not a risk-free effort that we're undertaking, but I think what we wanted to make sure is that the borough was not solely responsible for all activities.
The borough's concerns are valid, says Joe Ferguson of the DEC Commissioner's Office, and he'd expect that some negotiating on the terms of the funding might have to take place. But the liability issue might prove to be a sticking point.
Essentially, what this will probably boil down to is that the state will be liable for any kind of problems that might come under activities that we're doing, and the boroughs and local communities would be responsible for any liabilities that might occur from, you know, activities that they're supervising.
Both Ferguson and Jim Butler of the borough agreed that disposal of oiled waste is another problem. The DEC isn't offering any storage space. The borough has none, and if the material needed to be shipped outside, it might end up costing the borough more money than the funding it might receive. Aside from liability questions, the borough is now taking a second look at doing any cleanup work at all this winter. Butler says frigid conditions, storms, and darkness would make it dangerous, if not impossible, to get much accomplished. He says it may be better to look towards spring.
The borough just doesn't want to get people injured to try and clean up that oil. It's just too high a price to pay. We would like to make sure that there is a well-trained, well-organized, and well-prepared response corps ready to go as part of a planned attack in the spring. And we hope to use the winter months to test some of that, whether it's some techniques or whether it's the training.
The DEC has received the borough's list of concerns. Currently, the agreement is in the hands of lawyers who are working on the various points of contention. Joe Ferguson of the DEC said that the agreement is not being fought over. It's only being fine-tuned. Reporting from Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
The borough just doesn't want to get people injured to try and clean up that oil. It's just too high a price to pay. We would like to make sure that there is a well-trained, well-organized, and well-prepared response corps ready to go as part of a planned attack in the spring.
The evidence that I have in front of me is that Mr. Captain Hazelwood had several drinks. Saw a lot of evidence that indicated that people didn't believe he was intoxicated.
There was a lot of evidence to that effect, wasn't there?
Yes, and I kept saying, don't you think maybe we ought to drop this DWI? We don't have that much evidence.
I think we're finding out what we long suspected, that this was really, in essence, a political trial, and the decisions were made in Juneau and not at the local district attorney level. And we think these people had access to a lot of the information we're claiming is tainted.
I had to ask people to turn off the television, don't talk about that, even to some attorneys. I can't hear that kind of information, so please don't mention it anymore.
And when you would say, I can't hear that kind of information, it's because you had just heard some of that kind of information and you were trying to cut it off at that point.
Well, sometimes, I mean, you can see the direction that something's taking. I mean, and you can stop it before, but basically, I think I felt that I was able to stop it before I heard something that I shouldn't have. Yes. Honestly, I don't know how something like that can be avoided.
If I thought that I was going to be in a position where I might hear something that I shouldn't hear, sometimes I would tell them that part of the investigation I'm not allowed to know.
If it's a good day,
you pretty much want to get up and go see how things are, usually check on the boat and the skiff and just look around. So say if we got up around about 7 o'clock, we could probably be on the beach by 8, easy, or even sooner.
Do you remember March 24th, 1989?
Yes, I do.
Was it a good day or not a good day?
It was a very good day.
After a loaded tanker sailed out of Valdez with only temporary repairs the day after Thanksgiving, the commander of the port decided action had to be taken. He issued an order saying any tanker with a crack in the outer hull will not be allowed to load cargo in Valdez. A letter sent to Alyeska's marine terminal goes on to say that any oil already on a ship must be pumped off if a crack is found, and the tanker must return to the lower 48 in ballast to make repairs. The new ruling won't affect the Alyeska pipeline terminal too much. Spokesman George Jerkowicz says they wouldn't knowingly send a loaded cracked tanker out of Valdez, but if a crack is found in a tanker after it's partly filled with oil, the oil must be unloaded, and that would have to be to another tanker.
Vessels are loaded by gravity feed from the storage tanks or from the incoming pipeline, which are high on the hill, and there's no way to pump fuel or crude oil back up into those tanks from down at the berth. So what we have to do is pump it from one vessel at the berth to another vessel at another berth.
Jerkowicz says since they load about 3 tankers a day, there shouldn't be a problem having available space for oil to be offloaded. Alyeska and the Coast Guard both inspect tankers for cracks before they're loaded, but cracks are usually found during regular maintenance, and ARCO Marine President Jerry Asplund agrees. Even though the aging tanker fleet has the Coast Guard concerned, Asplund says maintenance is the key to keeping ARCO's fleet, average age 14 years, in good shape. He says ARCO Marine won't change any of its regular maintenance practices, and if they find a crack, they'll take appropriate action.
If the hull fracture were on the bottom and the requirement was to dry dock it, there aren't any dry docks in Alaska to handle the ship. So in that case, we would possibly have to go to the lower 48. On the other hand, if it's in what we would call the sides of the ship, we wouldn't go to the shipyard anyway to fix it. So we could fix it right there in Alaska.
Asplund says since this order came from the port of Valdez, it won't apply to the Cook Inlet trade. In Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.
I was irritated with the situation a little bit. Mark Delosier, an investigator with the Coast Guard, appears at our grand jury with 2 attorneys and generally gives the flavor of being uncooperative. And then I only to see him a week or so later in a bar with Captain Hazelwood's attorneys, I thought was a position not appropriate for him to be in.
In their original motion, the prosecution said the oil spill would have been discovered by at least 8 o'clock in the morning on March 24th. But as prosecutor Bob Linton questioned Bruce Blanford this morning, he was pushing that time back, trying to establish that the oil spill would have been discovered before dawn. Blanford came on watch at the Coast Guard's Vessel Control Center about 20 minutes to midnight and relieved Gordon Taylor of the watch. Taylor told Blanford the Exxon Valdez had radioed in, was shifting lanes to avoid ice, and that Hazelwood had said he'd call in once he was clear of the ice with a new estimated time of arrival at Naked Island, one of the prescribed checkpoints. Blanford said by 12:15, he was expecting that call.
It should have taken no more than probably an hour from the time he dropped the pilot till the time he would have been past the buoy and presumably clear of the ice.
On the record sheet Blanford had in front of him, he saw that the Exxon Valdez had dropped off the pilot at 11:26. 1 hour later, instead of reporting the vessel clear of ice, Captain Hazelwood reported the Exxon Valdez hard aground, evidently leaking some oil. When a recording of that transmission was played in court this morning, Hazelwood twisted in his chair and looked at the floor. Linton used testimony from Blanford and Coast Guard Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein to establish an alternative scenario to what actually happened. If Hazelwood had never made his report, Blanford said he would have tried soon to contact the ship to find out if it had cleared the ice and what time he could expect it to reach the Naked Island checkpoint. If he hadn't done that, the last time estimate on the record was that Hazelwood expected to reach Naked Island at 1 a.m. If Blanford couldn't reach the Exxon Valdez by radio, he said he would have asked other ships in the area to look for the missing tanker. The Chevron California was in radio contact with the Vessel Control Center. If the Exxon Valdez could still not be located, a search and rescue mission would have been initiated in cooperation with the Coast Guard's Juno Command Center. Judge Carl Johnstone has promised to rule this week if Hazelwood is immune from prosecution because he reported the spilled oil. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris. As Joseph Hazelwood walked out of the courtroom, he shook his head and with a hint of a smile asked, "Is this really about a ship running aground?" And he shook his head again, not really expecting an answer. I asked how he felt about the possibility of testifying at the hearing. He replied, "It won't be much." Defense attorney Dick Madsen says if Hazelwood does take the stand, his attorney's plan is simple.
Have him explain that he was aware of the statute and that he expected immunity by reporting an oil spill. That's all.
But the state would have a chance to cross-examine, and then Judge Carl Johnstone will consider the information in the affidavit with the testimony as he sorts out the facts and rules on whether Hazelwood is indeed immune from prosecution. Hazelwood's question as he left the courtroom was well taken. This hearing really has very little to do with a ship running aground. Instead, as defense attorney Madsen characterized the testimony,
it kind of sounded like the old Watergate days, you know. What did you know and when did you know it? That was the essence of today's testimony, was particularly with Mr. Ganelli's. What did he know, and when did he know it, and what did he do about it?
Dean Guanelli, Attorney General for the state in the Central Office of the Criminal Division, seemed to spend more time on break than in the witness chair. He was the first of only two witnesses for the day as hearings reached into the upper echelons of the state's Department of Law. Guanelli said he volunteered for assignment to the case and was first involved with attempting to prove the amounts of damage resulting from the spill. He went to Valdez to help District Attorney Bob Linton out and became progressively more involved in the decision-making process in the case. Guanelli testified that his office became aware of the immunity issue on March 28th. Defense Attorney Rick Friedman focused in on what Guanelli and others in the Department of Law knew by the end of March. Guanelli said they were aware of the immunity issue, but
frankly, at that time and to this very day, I do not know who specifically made a report about this, whether it was Captain Hazelwood or whether it was somebody at his direction, or who that report went to, whether it was to the Coast Guard or to somebody else. So I knew that that was an issue that needed to be considered, but I did not know specifically what statements, if any, it applied to.
You didn't know that when the ship went aground, Captain Hazelwood had radioed the Coast Guard?
I did not know that. I did not know that. That's correct.
And you didn't read that in the papers?
I do not recall reading that in the papers.
You didn't hear it on the radio or see it on TV?
No.
Friedman questioned Guanelli on the workings of the prosecuting teams, both clean and the one tainted by information gathered on March 24th. Guanelli's notes were meticulously entered as evidence, and then Guanelli's boss, Larry Weeks, was called to the stand. Weeks is the chief of criminal prosecution for the state and District Attorney Bob Linton's boss. But after Linton's cursory questioning, defense attorney Friedman decided he needed more time to study Mr. Weeks's notebook, and the hearing was recessed until Wednesday. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Sue Burris.